Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, March 31st, 2023. Court officials in New York City confirming that former President Donald Trump will turn himself in next Tuesday to be arraigned on criminal charges, following the grand jury's vote Thursday to indict him in relation to a payoff to a woman before the 2016 presidential election, a woman claiming to have had an affair with Donald Trump. Just ahead, reaction to the indictment from former Vice President Mike Pence, a possible Republican presidential candidate in 2024, Vivek Ramaswamy, who is a declared Republican presidential candidate, William Barr, former Attorney General under President Trump, also Democratic Congressman Dan Goldman, a former Trump impeachment counsel, and Donald Trump's attorney, Joe Tacopina. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris were asked for a comment on the Donald Trump indictment, but saying today, no comment. Also today, President Biden visiting Rolling Fork, Mississippi, where a powerful tornado a week ago killed 24 people and caused widespread damage, telling the residents there the federal government is not leaving until the area recovers. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg welcoming Finland's entry very soon into NATO membership, and remembering political satirist Mark Russell, who used song parodies to poke fun at elected officials over a long career. He has died at the age of 90. NBC4 in New York reporting that New York City is gearing up security again for possible protests and unrest after a Manhattan grand jury voted to indict former President Donald Trump on Thursday. As a precaution, the NYPD has ordered every member of the department to report in full uniform Friday. That order includes about 36,000 officers and 19,000 civilian employees as the department intensifies security measures ahead of what potentially could be a busy weekend of pro- and anti-Trump demonstrations throughout the city, especially in front of Trump Tower in Midtown. Mike Pence, former vice president under President Trump and a possible Republican presidential candidate in 2024 himself, who, if he runs, would be challenging the announced presidential candidacy of Donald Trump, today calling the indictment an outrage. Mike Pence spoke with National Review editor Rich Lowry at a conference hosted by the magazine.
You've denounced very forcefully the indictment of Donald Trump coming out of the Manhattan DA's office. Seems clearly a motivated prosecution. No one else would be prosecuted. No one with a different name would be prosecuted for this alleged offense. So we'll take that as a given. What do you say, though, to folks on our side who are obviously outraged by this and think the proper response is, in effect, giving up on fairness and neutrality? They don't play by the rules, so the only way it's going to stop is if we have a prosecutor somewhere in office who distorts the law and twists it to go and nail one of their people. Is that the correct approach, and how would you discuss it one way or the other?
Well, first, let me just say, I think the unprecedented indictment of a former president of the United States for a campaign finance issue is an outrage. And I think it's clear to the overwhelming majority of the American people that this is nothing short of a political prosecution being affected by a Manhattan DA who literally campaigned on bringing charges against one particular American. And I must tell you that that should be offensive to every American, left, right, and center. Every American deserves equal treatment under the law. And I believe the American people will see this for what it is. But to your point, the answer is not to become like them. The answer is to return to a commitment to the foundations of the rule of law enshrined in the Constitution of the United States. And the antidote to that ultimately is, you know, Vince Lombardi said sometimes there's no substitute for just going out and winning the ball game. Right? And I really do believe that whether it's local prosecutors' races or the highest office in the land, we've got to rally behind men and women that are committed to the principles at the heart of our republic, that are committed to equal justice before the law and to a fair administration of justice. I'm very troubled about that in another way, is that, you know, as I've traveled around the country, I was in Iowa this week, New Hampshire a little bit ago. Very nice states to visit this time of year. Nobody's talking about this stuff. I mean, literally, I was at the machine shed in Des Moines a couple of days ago, and I took questions for an hour. Nobody brought up all the different investigations and the drama that is an obsession of much of the national media. What they were talking about was the failed policies of the Biden administration at home and abroad, the fact that their families are struggling under the worst inflation in 40 years, the fact that we have a crisis at our southern border, war raging in Eastern Europe, China menacing in the Asia Pacific. I mean, there's a great deal of anxiety out there about the failure of President Biden, his administration, and Democrats in Washington, D.C., and I really do believe that the worst part of what happened yesterday is that at a time when we're facing large, intractable challenges at home and abroad, this will likely only serve to further divide our country. At a time when we ought to be finding ways to come together to face these challenges, to get our economy moving again, to tackle a national debt crisis, to rally around our liberties and our values, and to support our national defense. And the other thing is, Rich, I will tell you, having served many years on the International Relations Committee in the House, having traveled around the world as Vice President of the United States, I think the indictment of a former President of the United States on a campaign finance issue sends a terrible message to the wider world about American justice. Because I have to tell you, there are dictators and authoritarians around the world that will point to that to justify their own abuse of their own so-called justice system. So I'm very troubled by it, but I think the American people will see through it. But the key, I think, for conservatives going forward, the key for leaders in our party going forward, is not to be preoccupied on these issues, but to continue to focus on the real challenges facing the American people at home and abroad, and ensure that we elect leadership that will turn this country back to common sense conservative principles in 2024.
Former Vice President Mike Pence with National Review editor Rich Lowry. When Donald Trump turns himself in, again expected next Tuesday afternoon, he will be arraigned before New York Supreme Court Judge Juan Merchan. Former President Trump has kept up a steady stream of posts on his platform Truth Social in reaction to his indictment. The one today reads, "The judge assigned to my witch hunt case, a case that has never been charged before, hates me." His name is Juan Manuel Merchan, was handpicked by Bragg and the prosecutors, and is the same person who railroaded my 75-year-old former CFO, Alan Weisselberg, to take a plea deal. Plead guilty, even if you are not, 90 days, fight us in court, 10 years, life in jail. Vivek Ramaswamy, a Republican presidential candidate, also spoke at today's National Review Summit in Washington, referencing the indictment of his opponent.
What does meritocracy in government mean? Think about a different sphere of what the Constitution enshrines. Part of what we enshrined in 1776 in this country was that the people who we elect to run the government ought to be the people who actually run the government. That's what's enshrined in a three-part constitutional division of labor. And so what does merit mean there? Merit means that you earn, whoever is best at earning the trust as amalgamated and counted in the form of votes, is most meritocratically suited to actually run the country. I speak to you on a day where, whatever you think of the man, we have a prosecutor that's trying to intervene in that system and saying the people of this country should not be given that choice. An administrative state in this town that actually views the elected officials that sit at the White House down the street as an inconvenience, because it is the unelected class that today actually holds the keys to power. Yes, that goes to the idea of self-governance over aristocracy, but I think this idea of merit itself is woven into the American fabric, even in ways that you wouldn't think about it, not just in the American dream, but in our culture of free speech, not just in our culture of free speech, but even in the way we set up our system of constitutional self-governance in this country.
Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy He's also a businessman, author, and conservative activist today at the National Review Summit in Washington, D.C. This from CNN. Donald Trump faces more than 30 counts related to business fraud in an indictment from a Manhattan grand jury, according to two sources familiar with the case. The first time in American history that a current or former president has faced criminal charges. The indictment has been filed under seal and will be announced in the coming days. The charges are not publicly known at this time. William Barr, former Attorney General under President Trump, gave his reaction to the indictment at today's National Review Conference, sitting down with contributing editor Andrew McCarthy.
Well, I wish I had something original to say about this. Almost all the adjectives have been used. I mean, obviously, we have to caveat it. We haven't seen it. We don't know exactly what's there. But judging from the news reports, it's the archetypal abuse of the prosecutorial function to engage in a political hit job. And it's a disgrace if it turns out to be what we think it is. Politically, it's going to be damaging, I think, to the Republican Party, simply because I think it's a no-lose situation for the Democrats. I think the impetus is really to help Trump get the nomination, focus the attention on him for 2 years, have this thing swirling around, plus whatever else comes, which I think will be damaging to whoever gets the nomination. And legally, I think it's, from what I understand, a pathetically weak case.
Yeah, it seems to be that there's two aspects of this that are offensive. At least it seems this way to me. One is the business records part. And they've made a very strong push that they intend to litigate that to the hilt, mm-hmm. and that he did not commit even the misdemeanor. But it seems to me that whether he did or whether he didn't, the first obligation of the prosecutor is to apply the law equally across the board to everyone.
Right.
And we're dealing with a progressive prosecutor who's made his name not prosecuting. Right. So at the very time that he's taking real felonies that are preying on New Yorkers and knocking them down to misdemeanors if he prosecutes them at all, he's taking this case that they would never in a million years prosecute, and he's making it into a misdemeanor prosecution. And then there's the second question about whether, especially with the federal authorities who have jurisdiction over campaign finance violations, having looked at this and decided not to prosecute, he's now not only going to add this to his case, but use it to inflate the misdemeanor, not into a felony. I don't think it does it justice to say inflated into a felony. According to Trump's counsel, and again, as you say, until we see the indictment, we don't know, it's going to be 34 felonies, 4-year counts each.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear me? I guess they had my mic off. I'm sorry. Can you hear me now? Yeah. Okay. Well, that's right. Taking the federal issue first, which is the way he appears to defeat the statute of limitations on a misdemeanor and juices up a technical misdemeanor into a felony. As you say, the federal government, the Southern District of New York, did not charge this as a campaign violation. And I saw some editorialists said something like, well, that's because Bill Barr was there. Actually, the Southern District could have done whatever they wanted. Well, I mean, they would have eventually.
I always heard that about them.
Well, but I want to point out that the administration ended 2 years ago, so Bill Barr wasn't there 2 years ago. And if the statute of limitations had not run federally, they could have done whatever they wanted to do after I left. So no one's done anything.
Right.
And so for the state DA to try to use this as a way of bootstrapping himself into a felony is sort of outrageous. But as the other thing is, the statute itself isn't as technical as it sounds. That is, it's not just falsification of a record, but the statute says with the intent to defraud. So the falsification of the record has to have the intent to defraud. It's not enough to say, well, the falsification is the fraud. There still has to be some victim of fraud, someone who is some value is somehow taken away from and benefited, you know, the perpetrator. And I don't see an explanation for that anywhere. So I think it's a very weak case just on the misdemeanor. And on the federal issue, they've gotten the statute completely wrong in my mind. And I don't think the department would support this interpretation of the statute that they're taking, which is that paying, I'll call it hush money, I don't like that term, but paying hush money is a campaign contribution. I don't think the department would take that position now. I think the statute covers two different kinds of payments. Something that's a campaign contribution because it augments the campaign resources available to spend on a campaign, that's not what this is, or the payment of a personal expense that otherwise wouldn't be paid but for the election. The only reason you pay the personal expense is because the pendency of the election. And this was, even as alleged, this was a payment of a personal expense. And I don't think they can show it's not the kind of payment that would have been made in any case. It wasn't done because of the election. It was done to protect Trump's reputation. And an eponymous private company certainly has an interest in protecting the brand Trump. And it's the kind of thing that probably would have been paid but for the election. So I think the whole thing is a very weak case. But it's going to hurt our politics, obviously, for the next 2 or 3 years.
William Barr, former Attorney General during the Trump administration, with Andrew McCarthy, National Review contributing editor at today's National Review Summit in Washington. Associated Press writes, does President Joe Biden have any reaction to the indictment of former President Donald Trump? Is he concerned about possible protests or that the unprecedented indictment could further divide the nation? What does the indictment mean for the rule of law in the United States? President Biden's answer on Friday was the same each time. No comment, no comment, no comment. President Biden spoke to reporters as he left the White House this morning.
Are you worried this will further divide our country, the indictment?
I have no comment on that.
Mr. President.
Possible protests in the wake of the indictment?
No, I'm not going to talk about Trump's indictment.
Mr. President, you talking against Trump.
President Biden on the south lawn of the White House. You can hear the noise of Marine One, the presidential helicopter, in the background. From there, he went to Joint Base Andrews to get on board Air Force One, the presidential plane, for a trip to Mississippi. While in flight, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre spoke with reporters. She, too, would not comment on Donald Trump's indictment, but she did confirm that the president found out about it through public media reports.
Was the president briefed on the Trump indictment?
Look, we found out, all of us, including the president, found out about the news yesterday, just like every other American, through the news reports. His chief of staff, Jeff Zients, let him know what occurred through media reports, found out when it was not given a heads up. Again, through media reports, that's how we learned about.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters on Air Force One. She also, when asked about the possibility of violent protests, would not speculate what might happen, but reiterated the president supports Americans' right to protest peacefully. Congressman Dan Goldman, Democrat from New York, has written an opinion piece at MSNBC that reads in part, as a former federal prosecutor and the lead counsel in the first impeachment of President Trump, I helped prove that he abused the power of the presidency by extorting Ukraine for his personal benefit. I then ran for Congress principally on a platform of preserving and protecting our democracy and the rule of law. As Donald Trump faces the first of several possible indictments, we must affirm a core value that the former president rejects. No one is above the law. Congressman Goldman was on MSNBC this morning.
The law to Donald Trump does not apply to him.
And what we're seeing now is an even-handed, very nonpartisan, apolitical pursuit of facts and evidence. And I think we have a lot of evidence to support that view. Alvin Bragg did not charge Donald Trump a year ago over the recommendation of very experienced prosecutors. And so now that he has followed the facts and the law and the evidence, and we'll see what that all is as it unfolds in court, now he's getting attacked in a way that can't possibly be based on anything, because we don't know what the charges are. We don't know what the evidence is. And Donald Trump will have an opportunity to defend himself in court, just like every other defendant in America. And he can challenge the law if he doesn't believe it's a good legal theory. He can go to trial, confront witnesses, cross-examine them, and rely on the fact that there needs to be a unanimous verdict of 12 people to find proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the highest legal standard. And that's where this should play out, not in the halls of Congress or in the political sphere.
Congressman Dan Goldman, Democrat from New York, on MSNBC Friday morning. A story at the Washington Post: the office of New York County District Attorney Alvin Bragg on Friday urged House Republicans to withdraw a demand for information on its case against former President Donald Trump, again rebuffing what it characterized as unlawful political interference in an ongoing criminal case. In a letter to the three committee chairmen who are pressing for documents and testimony about Donald Trump's case, Leslie B. Dubeck, the general counsel for Alvin Bragg's office, chastised them for choosing to collaborate with the former president, who's now under indictment. That from the Washington Post. Joe Tacopina, an attorney for Donald Trump, was interviewed on ABC's Good Morning America, asked what Donald Trump's reaction was when he heard the news Thursday.
Initially shock, I will tell you.
Why was he shocked?
But after he got over that initial, you know, George, because at the end of the day, we were really hoping, and he was hoping, that that rule of law would have prevailed. And you know, look,
but he had predicted
there were all
his
these
own
rumors
arrest.
That, oh, he predicted his own arrest based on a leak, George, that had happened about 3 weeks ago, where there was a law enforcement meeting that was happening the day before to go through the logistics of an arraignment. So he predicted it based on rumors and leaks and whatnot. And this case has been permeated with rumors and leaks. You know, as of yesterday, there was a 4-week adjournment in the grand jury proceeding. So, you know, it was shocked because this actually is coming to fruition. I was always hoping that rule of law would have prevailed, George, but in my opinion, and I don't say this with pride or pleasure, in my 32 years as a lawyer, both as a prosecutor and defense attorney, I feel like the rule of law died yesterday in this country, and it's not something that I'm happy about.
Joe Tacopina, attorney for former President Trump, on Good Morning America with host George Stephanopoulos. He was also questioned about what happens next in the process.
So what should we all expect next week?
George, you know, it's a great question. This is unprecedented in this country's history. I don't know what to expect other than an arraignment, you know.
And what will that look
going
like?
Through that normal process. Your guess is as good as mine. I understand they're going to be closing off blocks around the courthouse, shutting down the courthouse. You know, we'll go in there and we'll proceed to see a judge at some point. Plead not guilty, start talking about filing motions, which we will do immediately and very aggressively regarding the legal viability of this case.
Mugshot, handcuffs, perp walk.
Look, I'm sure they'll try and get every ounce of publicity they can from this thing. The president will not be put in handcuffs. As far as the mugshot's concerned, perp walk, I mean, you know, I'm sure they'll try to make sure they get some, you know, joy out of this by parading him. But, you know, I think this is a different situation. You have Secret Service involved here, George. You have the New York State Court Officers Union with Dennis Quirk and his team, the police department. So it's a lot of groups involved here, and I don't think they're going to allow this to become a circus as much as humanly possible.
Joe Tacopina, attorney for former President Trump, on ABC's Good Morning America program. Reporters' questions about the indictment of former President Trump stretched halfway around the world today and were directed not just to U.S. public officials. Vice President Kamala Harris and the president of Zambia, Hakainde Hichilema, held a joint news conference in Lusaka.
We'll first start with Annie Linsky of the Wall Street Journal.
Madam Vice President, you've spoken about democracy and the rule of law at every stop in Africa. Given that, What is your comment on former President Donald Trump's indictment, and are you worried that his calls for protest could lead to a recurrence of the violence similar to that of January 6th? And a Wall Street Journal reporter has been detained in Russia. Do you have any update on his status? And what is your reaction to Vladimir Putin's decision to detain him? And for President Hishalima, what does Trump's indictment tell you about the example that the United States sets in terms of rule of law?
I am not going to comment on an ongoing criminal case as it relates to the former president, but I will say, as it relates to the American citizen that has been detained by the government of Russia, we are deeply concerned, and I will state in unequivocal terms that we will not tolerate and condemn, in fact, repression of journalists, and that we are absolutely concerned about any attempt to in any way stifle freedom of the press.
Understood?
Yes.
Right. The indictment of President Trump, what does that mean to rule of law? I think let's remove names from your question. Let's put what we decided we would do to govern ourselves in an orderly manner. First, our constitutions, bedrock law, then secondary laws, other regulations, create a platform or framework around which we agreed, either as Americans or as Zambians, to govern ourselves. And so to live within those confines. And when there's transgression against law, it does not matter who is involved. I think that is what the rule of law means. So I take out a name, I put in place of a name what we citizens of our countries, citizens of the global community, must do to, as we exercise our rights and freedoms, and where our rights and freedoms end, other people's rights and freedoms commence. This is universal, certainly for Zambia. This is the way it is. And here, Vice President, we have a scenario now when we fight against corruption, which is taking away resources from children and the sick. Sometimes names are thrown into it and perceptions are created that are totally inappropriate, because transgressions against the law, if you take what belongs to the public, you have offended the law, and the name does not matter. That is my answer. Thank you.
President of Zambia, Hakainde Hichilema, and U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris in Lusaka, capital city of Zambia. Back to Vice President Harris at the news conference, she also spoke about the fact that she is returning to Zambia. She visited as a young girl when her maternal grandfather worked in the country.
My visit to Zambia has a special significance for me, as many of you know, and for my family. As you know, I visited Zambia, Mr. President, as a young girl when my grandfather worked here. My grandfather was a civil servant in India. And in 1966, shortly after Zambia's independence, he came to Lusaka to serve as a director of relief measures and refugees. That was his title. He served as an advisor to Zambia's first president, Kenneth Kaunda, and he was an expert on refugee resettlement. I remember my time here fondly. I was a child, so it is the memory of a child. But I remember being here and just how it felt, and the warmth and the excitement that was present. And in fact, I was talking with my aunt recently, and she was reminding me of the relationships that she made when she was working at, then it was called Lusaka Central Hospital, when she was working there with the physicians there. So from my family, And from all of us, we extend our greetings and hello to everyone here.
Vice President Kamala Harris in Lusaka, Zambia. She was also able to go to the exact spot where her grandfather's house stood in the city in the 1960s. The home is no longer there. There's an office building. Associated Press reports that officials at the U.S. Embassy in Lusaka poured through public records, spoke with Zambian and Indian authorities, and reached out to former Zambian government officials to identify the precise location of the home. Vice President Harris's family members also offered memories about the home, and the spot was identified just a couple of days ago when Vice President Harris was in Ghana, the first stop on her week-long trip to Africa. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden traveling to Mississippi today, about a week after that line of tornadoes barreled through, killing at least 26 people, causing immense property damage. ABC News reports the first couple toured Rolling Fork, Mississippi, a Delta region city pummeled by a tornado, which is later assigned the rare and powerful classification rating of EF4. Across the state, one long track twister left a trail of destruction for about 59 miles, according to officials. The president approved disaster relief for the state on Sunday. A lectern was set up in the town, piles of debris seen behind. In introducing the president, Mississippi's Republican governor, Tate Reeves.
When I left Rolling Fork on Saturday morning, I'd already heard from the FEMA administrator and I'd heard from Secretary Mayorkas. As I was pulling out of Rolling Fork Saturday morning to hit the other spots, I got a call from the White House. That call was from the president. The president told me two things, and I believe both of them. The first thing he said is, we're going to expedite the signing of the declaration so we can get resources to the people who need it. I said, Mr. President, you'll have it within an hour. He had the declaration within an hour, and before the end of the day, it was back. He expedited it, and the people of Mississippi, Mr. President, appreciate it. The second thing he said that day on that phone call was, we're going to be there to help, and we're going to stay to the end. And I believe him, and I appreciate him. I appreciate the call on Saturday, and I appreciate the fact that the President of the United States is standing here in Sharkey County, Mississippi, to deliver more remarks today, to hear from the people most affected, and most importantly, as he and Dr. Biden have done throughout the day, show compassion for those who have been most affected. So without further ado, please give a warm Mississippi welcome to the President of the United States. Thank you, Mr. President, for being here.
Governor Tate Reeves, Republican from Mississippi in Rolling Fork. President Biden speaking next, announcing that the federal government will pay 100% of tornado damage cleanup costs for the next 30 days.
13 lives lost. I met a number of the families earlier today, Jill and I, my wife and I. 300 homes and businesses are nothing more than piles of twisted materials mixed up with personal items that mattered so much. Teddy bears, family albums, clothes, dishes, basic of life, all gone. People still going through the rubble, seeing if they can find that picture of grandma or that wedding ring that was on the bureau or that special memento that meant so much to them. They get lost, too. Some of this dysfunction and destruction that you're seeing here is going to take years to recover and rebuild. But we're starting now. When I spoke to the governor, he said what he needed most was a federal disaster declaration so that the earliest hours of Sunday morning, I signed that expedited major disaster declaration, which gave you more access to more federal resources. With that declaration, we're providing funding to cover overtime for local emergency responders, to cover the cost of removing all debris, 100% of that cost. We're also authorizing cash grants for people who lost their homes, whether they own or rent, to pay for things that may not be covered by insurance, like temporary housing, home repairs for those who have homes still standing, or to replace lost personal property, like furniture and appliances and vehicles. You know, after talking to Benny and your governor, today I authorized the federal government to cover 100% of the cost for removing debris and emergency measures that are involved in keeping up here by keeping shelters up and running and paying for every overtime for everyone. 100% of the cost, not for the state, but for us, for 30 days. And then after that, we're not leaving either. In the midst of all you're dealing with, I know that it's overwhelming. You figure out, got to figure out how we can help, what you need. That's why right now we have 300 federal personnel on the ground, including FEMA's disaster survivor assistance teams, to ensure a well-coordinated response to get you the assistance you need. We're walking through damaged neighborhoods to find people in need and help them. They're walking through now. Going on, if there's any doors to knock on or people stand there just to find out where everyone in that house was or is.
President Biden in Rolling Fork, Mississippi, his first visit to the state as president. On Wall Street, the Dow up 415, S&P up 58, NASDAQ up 208. A story from Bloomberg, President Vladimir Putin approved a new Russian foreign policy concept that set out to confront the U.S. and its allies, claiming an era of revolutionary changes was underway in international relations. The U.S. is, quote, the source of fundamental risks to the security of the Russian Federation, and most European states are pursuing an aggressive policy aimed at undermining Russia's sovereignty, according to the 42-page document signed by the president on Friday. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg welcoming today the Turkish parliament's ratification of Finland's application to join NATO, the 30th and last member nation to ratify, clearing the way for Finland to become the 31st member of the military alliance. Secretary General posting a video.
I welcome the vote by the Turkish Grand National Assembly to ratify Finland's membership in NATO. All 30 NATO allies have now ratified the accession protocol. And I have just spoken with President Sauli Niinistö to congratulate him on this historic occasion. Finland will formally join our alliance in the coming days. Their membership will make Finland safer and NATO stronger. Finland has highly capable forces, advanced capabilities, and strong democratic institutions. So Finland will bring a lot to our alliance. All allies made a historic decision last year to invite Finland and Sweden to join our alliance. Since then, we have seen the fastest ratification process in NATO's modern history. All allies agree that the rapid conclusion of the ratification process for Sweden will be in everyone's interest. I look forward to also welcoming Sweden as a full member of the NATO family as soon as possible.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg in a video today. Turkey has not indicated whether it will approve Sweden's NATO membership application. Also, Hungary has delayed consideration of Sweden to join. An article at Al Jazeera explains Sweden, Finland, and Turkey signed a trilateral memorandum at a NATO summit in June last year to secure the start of the accession process. However, Ankara has repeatedly butted heads with Stockholm, saying its demands have remained unfulfilled, particularly for the extradition of Turkish citizens that Turkey wants to prosecute for terrorism. Secretary of State Antony Blinken thanking State Department employees for their work last month in helping to resettle to the United States 222 freed political prisoners from Nicaragua. Secretary Blinken saying at the time the prisoners had been jailed by Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega for exercising their fundamental freedoms and have endured lengthy, unjust detentions. Today's ceremony held at the State Department in Washington.
I have to admit, I wasn't so sure this was really going to come together. I had a funny feeling, oh, this is going to fall apart. It seems almost too good to be true. But too good to be true because so much work actually goes into this. These things don't just happen. It takes the incredible effort that started in Managua to actually get it done. From there, more than 350 of our colleagues from the U.S. government, as well as partners from the state of Virginia, NGOs, you all took over. You worked around the clock, you worked through the weekend, reuniting prisoners with their loved ones. You interpreted for them. You provided them with food, with clothing, with health care. You helped them through the jarring process of starting a new life far from their homes and their communities. And what I heard also in the stories that were told is I think you all responded in a powerfully human way, because I imagine as you're there with someone who has just had this absolute sea change in their life, you're thinking and feeling and understanding how totally jarring and disorienting that is, even in this incredibly positive way. And the humanity that you showed as fellow human beings and helping them navigate this particular passage, that in and of itself is hugely important. And indeed, it wasn't just what you did, it's how you did it, with care, with compassion, by asking each of our Nicaraguan friends, how are you doing? Are you okay? What do you need? Probably a question they hadn't been asked in a long, long time.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the State Department in Washington. The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, tweeting today, "This morning, I met with Nicaraguan exiles and refugees who have fled the repressive Ortega Murillo regime. I stressed our continued support for returning Nicaragua to democracy and for activists and journalists who are showing such bravery in the face of oppression." Today is International Transgender Day of Visibility, which, according to a CNN article, was founded in 2009 by Rachel Crandall, a Michigan-based transgender activist and the executive director of Transgender Michigan. It was started as a day of awareness to celebrate the successes of transgender and gender nonconforming people, and is an important day for the LGBTQ community. A Democratic congressman from Florida posting this video.
"Hello, everybody. This is Congressman Maxwell Alejandro Frost. And this Trans Day of Visibility, we celebrate all of our transgender and non-binary community all across Florida's 7th Congressional District and the entire country. I'll be honest, I can't wait for the day where on days like this, we can just celebrate wins, celebrate the community, celebrate the love, and celebrate the creativity that all of our trans and non-binary family give to us as a country and as a humanity. But right now we know in Florida that trans kids, trans community is under attack by a far right-wing regime, the governor's mansion, that is using their existence to score political points. And I want everyone to know that at this point, we need more than allies, we need accomplices. People are gonna fight day and night, because it can't just be up to the trans community to fight for their own rights. It has to be every single one of us fighting every single day. And so on Trans Day of Visibility, you know, it's more than just about visibility, but it's about solidarity, and solidarity is a verb. And so to all of our trans and non-binary folks, I love you, we fight with you, and I hope you have a great day. Thank you so much."
Congressman Maxwell Frost, Democrat from Florida, in that video he tweeted. A Pew Research study last year found 1.5% of U.S. adults identify as transgender or non-binary. That is, their gender differs from the sex they were assigned at birth. That percentage rises for adults under 30 years old to 5.1%. And finally, the piano-playing political song satirist Mark Russell has died at the age of 90. New York Times writes, "With his deadpan solemnity, stars and stripes stage sets, and fusty bow ties, Mr. Russell looked more like a senator than a comic. But as the Capitol merry-go-round spun its peccadilloes, scandals, and ballyhooed promises, his jaunty baritone restored order with bipartisan japes and irreverent songs to deflate the preening ego and the big idea." C-SPAN covered him many times over the decades, including a National Press Club appearance in 1992, where he poked fun at the Democratic presidential ticket that year.
"Two Southern boys, I love it. Ah, Bill Clinton has arrived at last. Kindly disregard his past. Look away, look away. Look away from his past. So cast your vote for the man from hope. He never inhales smoke and dope. Look away, look away, look away from his past. So Bill and Al's the ticket. Hooray, hooray. These two white boys are all we've got, so vote for them, said Jesse. Hooray, hooray. So vote for them, said Jesse. Best good old boys to be had, an Oxford lad and a Harvard grad. Far away, far away, far away from the South. These blow-dry yuppies will devote their time to beg for Bubba's vote. Look away, look away, look away, Bubba's vote. So Bill and Al's the ticket. Hooray, hooray. Campaigning far and wide to every country club in Dixie. Hooray, hooray. Country club in Dixie. There we have it right there.
Mark Russell in 1992 at the National Press Club from C-SPAN's Video Library. He has died at the age of 90. The Wrap reports that Mark Russell was a member of the National Comedy Center Advisory Board and was remembered by fellow member John Stewart, who said, Mark Russell was a DC institution who did the hardest thing a comic can do, relentlessly and righteously mock his neighbors. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.